Okay, I'll make a start. Thank you, everyone. Welcome to this session this afternoon. My name is Neil Newman. I'm the Branch Network Manager at AAT. Happy to take any questions about your local branch or any of our products and services that we offer to you as our members after the session during the coffee break. So I'll move on very quickly and introduce our speakers for this session. Lynn Rowlands and John Claypool from Mazars, and the session Inheritance Tax Planning and Latest Developments. And over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Neil.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. If you hadn't worked it out, I'm Lynn and this is John. So today we're going to talk to you about inheritance tax and hopefully go on to some later in the session for some ideas that might help you in your discussions with clients. And I know that we're quite tight for time today, but if you've got any burning questions, please interrupt us as we're going through, because I think it's quite important that you put them into the context of what we're talking about at the time. And so without any further ado, let's just start at looking at the basics. So, here we go. Right. First of all, let's start off by looking at that wonderful quote that I'm sure you've all heard of before from Benjamin Franklin. And I would challenge you and ask you whether you think this is still a valid statement today. And I don't think there's too much we can do about death, unless you know better than I do. But actually, we like to think that certainty around paying tax, certainly inheritance tax, is not necessarily there. It might be seen as an optional tax if you're undertaking tax planning and you're thinking about things well in advance. And so perhaps by the end of this session, you might agree with me that perhaps it's not as certain as that quotation may lead you to believe. And if we look at the total tax take over the last couple of years, it's up there on the screen, we can see it's gone up slightly in the year to 5th of April 2012. But if you look below that, the inheritance tax portion of that is tiny. In fact, it's so tiny, if you look at a lot of the government statistics, it's quite hard to find those stats. They're normally lumped in together with something like stamp duty. And so a lot of people think inheritance tax, gosh, that's terrible. Why should people have to pay this? But if you put it into the overall context of the total taxes we're paying in the UK, it still represents quite a small proportion.
And indeed, if you look at that in the context of government finances, it doesn't even hit the radar screen. It's minute.
So we go on just a little bit, just again to put things into context. The Inheritance Taxes Act came in 1984, and prior to that we had the capital transfer tax. And I do have to confess that when I started working in tax, that was in the inheritance tax regime, but some of you may remember capital transfer tax. And the taxes are slightly different, but you can see if you look back through the history how we've got to the inheritance tax regime that we have today. So where we're starting off with is originally a regime that taxed every lifetime transfer into inheritance tax, where actually not all lifetime transfers are chargeable. So we start off with that premise, and then we move into adapting those rules for events such as death and gifts with reservation. And we will home in on gifts with reservation because they do feature quite a lot in tax planning that when we're talking to clients, because quite often people think, I've done this wonderful piece of planning, I've got something out of my estate, isn't that great? And they've reserved a benefit, which actually means that all that they've gone through has been a complete waste of time because it's still going to fall in their estate on death. So we may come back and talk on this a little bit later, but a typical example of that might be somebody giving away their home and staying in it. And we'll sort of expand on that later. So under the new regime, we had a new concept called potentially exempt transfers. As I mentioned earlier, not everything is chargeable if it's made during lifetime. But again, we'll expand on this as we go through. So this is just to set the scene. So not everything or every gift or transaction is taxable for IHT purposes. Sorry.
So I'll control this.
Thank you. Don't overlook the basics. And today I really want to home in on keeping things basic, going back to basics, and don't overcomplicate things. You don't necessarily need to. So you've got a whole load of exemptions listed there. I'm sure you can all read. I don't need to go through that for you. But it's really, really important that you don't forget about these. If you're thinking about your typical client, £3,000 annual exemption for each spouse or civil partner, if you add that up over, say, a 20-year period, it's quite a significant sum that could make a real difference to other members of their family if they were so minded to gift in that way, and it doesn't impact on their nil rate band. And just to make sure that you're all aware that the nil rate band for inheritance tax is currently £325,000. And if one spouse doesn't use it, it can be transferred to another spouse. You've got £650,000 between you. So that number is quite important, and we'll come into that quite a lot through this session. But as I say, don't forget the basics and think about the exemptions and make sure you use them. I think the most important one there from a tax planning perspective is the one that I've put right at the bottom. And this is so often overlooked by clients, especially wealthy clients. And we've got a few live examples, haven't we, John? That which is just one or two that we might touch on now, just to explain how this can be so useful as a tool.
Yeah, I mean, the point Lynn makes is right. Gifts out of normal income, there's absolutely no limit to it. There's no cap to it. It's facts and circumstance dependent. So that's the base point to start with. One particular client we've got, he's reasonably wealthy. In fact, I'd say actually very wealthy, but his income stream is such that he keeps within his current bank account a balance, and it'd be nice to have it, a balance of roughly £1 million in his current bank account. Yeah, I know. But what we do out of that account periodically is just make substantial gifts to his family, because it's out of his current account and that's regularly being topped up at that kind of level out of his income stream. Simply no challenge. There can be no challenge on that. And that's relying on HMRC's own guidance. And that's a number that fits his circumstances. But as a point of principle, his income is at a level to maintain that. And payments out of the current bank account is a classic example where it's free from inheritance tax. So it's fact and circumstance dependent. We'll touch on it later on. The important thing is documenting gifts out of income. It's very difficult for the executor after the event to be able to demonstrate, when it's so much easier as advisors just to help clients or you'll document on their behalf the discussions that have been had, the amounts that have been paid, where they've been paid from, and then that just deals with any potential challenge that might come along post-death in particular. I think the other one as well, and I think the two main ones, the annual exemption and the prior year, if unused, is often overlooked, and very small, but you can make any number of £250 gifts per year, so literally any amount. So again, there are two or three other options there that really make these exemptions. They're statutory, there's no debate, there's no discussion to be had with the government authorities about them, and they're there and they're often overlooked.
Yeah, so I think the key there is the documentation. So even if you're making a gift in contemplation of marriage to a close relative, cover it with a letter, not just send them a cheque. So you've got some evidence there that that's the intention. So if we move on from there, I've quoted some legislation on the next bit, just so you can look back on it. We're not going to read through this, but really we're going to now look at, we talk about exemptions when you make gifts. This is what the legislation calls a transfer of value. And this is just here for your reference, because I think it's quite important that you understand that it's not just a case of I'm making a gift of X, that's the amount that my estate is going to be reduced by. For example, if you had some shares or a property, what you have to look at is the value of your estate before you make the gift, compare it to the value afterwards. And it's not necessarily as simple as saying, well, the shares are worth X, that's the difference in the value. If you have shares, for example, you could have a majority or a minority interest, and it's a computation there and some negotiation around that value. And so it's key that you look at before and after, not just what you think the value is of whatever you've given away. So it's not something that it's always easy to do. A property, for example, if you have several properties or an estate and you're giving part of an estate away, you might be giving a part of an estate away, for example, that had a ransom strip in it. And that in itself might be a very small piece of land, but it could be extremely valuable in the overall context of what you own. So again, the valuation is not just a case of what is that small piece that I'm giving away. And that's what's key for inheritance tax purposes when you're looking at gifting, when you're looking at value of estates, and when you're looking at any lifetime transfers. So it's a slightly different concept to how you might normally approach it.
And it's drafted that way to deal with the shares, the value issue type examples. You know, cash is very straightforward. That's a reduction of cash. But it's drafted in a rather long-winded way for that deliberate purpose.
Yes, because I think if there was any issue with HM Revenue and Customs, they've got their own valuations team. If you can prove that you had some independent third-party valuations done and that was the value that you used for the purpose of making your gift, then that's obviously going to be evidence that's going to be really helpful rather than trying to reconstruct that some point in the future.
I think as an extension to that, Lynn's absolutely right. I mean, my role within Mazars is head of the tax investigations team and every day we are batting with HMRC on whatever the issues are. Only yesterday I was on a conference call with a client where we're trying to retrieve data back to 2008, which in your scenario, madam, if that client had documented in 2008 that scenario, we wouldn't need the conversation. HMRC would go away. So I would always encourage that.
Okay. So if we set the scene on what is a transfer, let's start off by looking at what is an exempt transfer, because not all transfers are going to be immediately taxable, if at all. So any transfers between a spouse or a civil partners, and you have to forgive me, now in legislation, spouse and civil partners are sort of interchangeable. Any limits, any transfers between those relationships, tax-free. And that's fine. So most people think, well, that's okay. I'm going to leave everything to my spouse or my civil partner. I don't need to worry about any inheritance tax. That's fine. All you're doing is building up a problem on the second death, but we'll come on to that later. The other slight quirk is that this is fine, but if you've got one spouse that has a different domicile to another, then you're limited. It's not an unlimited amount. You're limited to £55,000. And just to explain what I mean by that, is somebody is normally non-domiciled if they're born overseas or their father is born overseas, for example. We could have a whole session on this. But once you've been resident in the UK for 17 out of 20 years, you're deemed domiciled, and so you're treated as if you were born in the UK. But whatever happens, if you've got UK situs assets, those are going to fall within the UK inheritance tax net. But if you've got a spouse with a different domicile, and you're transferring assets to that spouse, what you're doing is transferring those assets outside of the UK tax net, which is why there's a limit put on that to discourage it. So you have to be very careful where you have spouses with mixed domicile. That's a point that's quite often overlooked.
We have a client at the moment with just this issue. The husband's married into an extremely wealthy family. His wife's worth about 20 million. And unfortunately, her mother passed away reasonably recently, and it focused their minds and kind of said, OK, we need to do some inheritance tax planning. And if she passes away and she can only give 55,000 of that estate to her husband without tax, that's a huge inheritance tax liability. So we're having to, quite frankly, we really have to scratch our heads a bit on how we deal with that as an issue. And he's not yet deemed domicile. So it 55,000 limit's been in there from time immemorial, so it's very out of date. And we'll see later on that there's a proposal to kind of reconsider that, which is long overdue probably. But just be alive to the fact if we've got people who and you've got one non-domicile person, how this could have an impact. And if nothing else, it's in those circumstances, it's a reason to have a conversation with the client, because it's clearly a very tax-effective issue for them.
So if we start off looking at exempt transfers, now we go on to this next concept that came in 1984 of potentially exempt transfers. And what we're saying here is you can make a transfer to another person of an unlimited amount. It's only exempt if you survive 7 years after making that gift. And so at the time you make it, it is only potentially exempt. And again, all this comes down to documentation. If you make any gifts, or your clients make any gifts, you must encourage them to document it. It's so much easier just to sort of look at things that have been documented, trying to reconstruct things, and I can't emphasise that enough. It's very difficult if you haven't got the original paperwork or original audit trail to work out what the intention was. If you make a gift and you die within the 7-year period, but you survive more than 3 years after making the gift, there is some relief. There's a taper relief applied and the rates are set up there. So you could end up having, you know, a partial relief, which is better than nothing. So we always say, just because somebody is quite elderly doesn't mean to say they can't make gifts. Potentially after 3 years, there's some taper relief there and it's still worth having. No, there isn't. No. No upper limit.
Which I think it's a good question because it comes up quite regularly, because I think there's a general misunderstanding that pets are connected to the nil rate band of 325,000, and there's kind of a connection between the two, and there isn't. You can gift any amount without limit, providing you survive 7 years. It's outside your estate, and it's effectively, depending on the age and circumstances, and it's a gamble between years three and, or between years one and seven in reality. We'll come on to that.
You've seen my slides.
Hold on, is it the next one?
Not quite. So we've started off with exempt transfers, we've gone on to potentially exempt, and these are transfers that are chargeable during lifetime. So if you make a transfer into a discretionary trust, unless you have your nil rate band available, it will be immediately chargeable to inheritance tax at half the death rate. There could be a 20% charge on making that transfer. So that perhaps there's a question mark in some people's minds about, should I be using trusts in my tax planning? We'll come on to that again in a minute. But that is the current law. Anything over the nil rate band, so if you've used the nil rate band already, then potentially you have to make a charge if you set a trust up.
And it's hard cash immediately,
yeah.
And it's not recoverable. It's pure sink cost, so it's quite inefficient.
So that is a key area, I think. If clients like the ideas of trust, maybe they've got, I don't know, profligate children, for example, or children that have married into somebody that's in their mind is unsuitable. They may wish to set up a trust. As long as it's within the nil rate or their available nil rate band, that's fine. They can be a trustee, for example, and sort of help to guide what happens with that money. But you have to look at, do you actually want that structure more than you want a potential tax charge, depending on the amounts that are going to be settled? We do have some ideas around that, which hopefully we'll have time to cover later. But it, as John said, it's a sink cost. It's a sunk cost. You can't get that back. If you put that in there, and say you wind the trust off in, you know, 12 months' time, you don't get any relief for that money that you've paid over already. So we won't spend a lot of time on this one. Just to sort of, again, for the sake of completeness, there are some transfers that are regarded as non-taxable, as you would imagine. But I list them there so you can refer back to them. So these would not be regarded as a transfer for inheritance tax purposes. If we move on again, I think this is the next slide is probably a little bit more interesting. We talked about making gifts or making transfers, but I think there are some golden rules that you need to remember when you're gifting. So John highlighted an example of where making gifts, regular gifts or gifts out of regular income is really important and shouldn't be overlooked. One of the key things that we find clients want advice on time and time again is, what do I do with the family home? That is probably the most emotive asset most people have. And this is the area where they can really fall foul of lots of tax legislation, whether it's inheritance tax or stamp duty, whatever. There is just so many pitfalls here. But it's the thing that most people want to talk about because it's usually their most valuable asset. So if you give your family home away, for example, you don't have any funds, you know, reciprocated back, you don't continue to live in that house in any way, fine. Complete break, If you can afford to do that, that's marvellous. However, most people can't. So usually there's a halfway house where you might give your home away, and if you wanted to remain in there, you'd have to pay a market value rent. If you did that, that is not perceived to be retaining a benefit in that asset. Although I must admit, most people find that quite bizarre, having to pay rent for what they still regard mentally as their home. And most people these days are worried about, oh, I can't afford to give everything away. What if I have to go into a care home? That seems to be another key worry and why people want to hold on to these things. So, as I say, you can do it, and if you've got sufficient resources to enable you to pay rent, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. After 7 years, that would come out of your estate completely.
And if it is such an emotive issue. Elderly people looking to obviously want to do the right thing by looking after their family, so gifting the property rather than it going to the state or in any way, shape or form, so that's good. But they kind of often have been in the home for many years. It's been the family home, so there's an emotional attachment to it. So therefore, that's a deep tie, clearly. Paying market rent, certainly in the southeast, paying market rent for properties, cash flow-wise, causes a problem, particularly where people are asset-rich and cash-poor, and that happens quite regularly. Actually, paying market rent is a useful way of decreasing the estate further, when you think about it. But it only if you've got the cash to do it. And there's something, again, that emotional attachment about, well, why should I be paying rent in my own home that I've lived in for years? It causes all sorts of conflicts. Some clients can get their heads around that and kind of see it for what it is. Others can't, and it's have the conversation. Some will go for it and some won't.
We do see quite a lot of very aggressive tax planning around the family home. And I think you've got to have a certain appetite to be able to take that sort of thing on. Not only is it expensive, you bet your bottom dollar that the revenue will be knocking on your door and asking some questions about it. So,
yeah, there are planning schemes around the family home out there. You may have seen some of them. More often than not, they involve transferring the asset to a third party, joint ownership of that vehicle, that often offshore, and you end up having to pay fees for the management of that vehicle, and they rely on various kind of reading of the legislation that I know for a fact HMRC don't agree with. So when you look at it, and sometimes you end up paying stamp duty on it as well for the transfer, by the time you look at the whole thing in the round and the uncertainty that's presented by it, we've presented it to a couple of clients who have had that attitude, had the right attitude of mind at the beginning. Then when you've talked them through it and the costs over an indeterminate period while somebody's still alive, it's just like, no, I'm not interested. Just don't go that far.
So I think one of my golden rules is, let's look at everything before we get to the family home, because it is such an emotive asset held within anyone's estate. The point after that, use them or you lose them. I think that, I spoke before about the fact that some of these annual exemptions aren't huge. But what's the point in not using them? They're there, and as John said, they're there statutorily. So there's no argument over it. You can bring forward 1 year the annual exemption. That's it. It's gone if you don't use it. The next point is, we talked about making trusts. We talked about pets and how if you survive 7 years, they fall out of your estate. But if you're going to do pets or make pets and set up a trust, you need to think about the order that you do it in, just in case you don't survive the 7 years. So if you're setting up a trust, for example, within the nil rate band, you should do that first, date-wise, before you make any pets, because if then something happens, on your death, you would look back 7 years and just see how you've used your nil rate band. There's no point using it against a pet, because you actually may get some relief anyway if you've survived more than 3 years from making the gift. So just think about the order that you do things in as well. It can make a bit of difference. People overlook the fact that both spouses and civil partners have all these exemptions. Sometimes the assets are in the wrong place. So another opportunity to talk to your clients is actually, are the assets in the right place? If you want to start thinking about planning for inheritance tax, you may need to do a little bit of movement round. And if there's no tax charge on moving these assets around, that's great. Move them around, get them into the right place, and make sure that you use both exemptions, both nil rate bands, to maximise the opportunities. But sometimes it's sitting down with a couple and actually getting them to actually agree to move things around. That can be quite difficult, can't it?
It is, and you raise a really good point, Lynn. We had just thinking about two of our clients, husband and wife, Lynn, that we did this exact same exercise with. A number of properties, quite how they got in this order, I don't know, but they got a number of properties. One's a farm, so we'll come on to that in a moment. But most of them seem to be held in the wife's name, for some reason or other, just many years ago. They're both in their 80s. And we kind of sat down with them and just worked through, what is it, they've got three children, eight grandchildren, so they've got all the generations they wanted to accommodate. And we ended up transferring a couple of properties into spouse to use exemptions, to use the opportunity to then set up trusts. And for some reason or other, why those assets have got held in the, excuse the background noise, got held in that order was a bit of a mystery. They couldn't even answer themselves. So sitting down and just having that wide-ranging discussion, it clearly helped. And I think this is one of the biggest issues in inheritance tax. Clients have got to be in the right mind to want to consider it. You know, it's a very emotive subject in itself. And there's no point asking a 40-year-old to talk about inheritance tax planning. We actually had to do that quite recently, didn't we? He was ready to do that at 40. Quite why, I don't know. Some 80-year-olds are. One client I can think of is just, he's going to die in his work chair, and he doesn't care less about inheritance tax planning. There's no rhyme or reason, and having clients in the right mindset is the first part of the exercise.
And I think it's just an opportunity to talk to your clients about this, because if you're not, perhaps somebody else is talking to them about it. So again, it's just being that trusted advisor and making sure that you're there. It may not be the right time for them, but at least you've raised it with them. So I just mentioned there as well, claim gift aid where possible. So if you're just making a gift to a charity, make sure it's done tax efficiently. You're probably all aware of that anyway.
Can I have that show of hands of people who actually do gift aid claims properly? Well done. I'm in that camp that doesn't.
So the title of this talk was Trust and Inheritance Tax. So I think if we just move on very, very quickly. Legislation talks about settlements. I think we tend to talk about trusts. They're sort of one and the same. So I've set out there the basic guidance, the basic legislation for you. We don't need to go through that. Basically, you don't need a trust deed to have a settlement. I think that's the point we're trying to show you there. It can be verbal. It can be set up in so many different ways, but you just need to understand what the tax and the accounting implications are when you do have a settlement.
And the phrase settlement and trust are really interchangeable. Personally, I just talk about trusts rather than settlements, but I tend to find lawyers talk about settlements and tax advisors talk about trusts. Have we got any lawyers in the house?
That's all right then.
no disrespect to lawyers, it's just it's all about the training, I think.
Yeah.
I have a question as well. More and more we've been talking to clients and they've less and less interested in the concept of having a trust. Thinking of some clients recently, they're almost shying away from trusts, and we'll talk about the mechanics of trust in a moment. But any show of hands of people that kind of just trusts are out of date, or clients, people generally just think they're not serving a purpose in the 21st century.
Perhaps no views.
Yeah. But that's always been there, hasn't it?
You just need to be more aware of it.
Yeah. And that's exactly the comments we've had back. Have you got an alternative to a trust that doesn't cost me admin fees?
What's the word in the second
line? We were talking about this
well
earlier.
Done.
Yes. That, no, I didn't either, actually. Well, I looked at that, I have to confess. It means you can do it verbally as well. It's not something that I tend to use on a daily basis, I have to say.
It's a testament to Lynn's planning, though, for this, that she actually, she said to me earlier on, oh, I had to go and research what that meant. And shall we move on?
Yes. So, 22nd of March 2006, if you work in the private client tax industry, as I do, that date will come back to haunt you, because on that date, that's when we had the Finance Act 2006 was announced, and there were some dramatic changes to trusts that weren't expected. They were completely left field. So many lawyers we spoke to after that date just felt, my gosh, a huge portion of our business has just gone. We can't see the future for trusts. That's not quite the case, but at the time, people were really panicking and thinking, that's it, we're going to have to wind up every trust that we've got. They're not going to be fit for purpose. The tax is going to be too onerous. So I mentioned that when we changed from capital transfer tax to inheritance tax, there was a slight change in the emphasis in the way that the law was intended to operate. So what we've got now is a regime whereby any new trust set up since the 22nd of March 2006 all fall within one major taxing regime, which is the same as what you call discretionary trusts, unless there are some special exemptions from that. And what that generally means is that you will have this tax charge on setting the trust up that we've talked about already, and every 10 years there is, well, it's a 10-yearly charge, and that could be a maximum of 6% of the value of the assets held within that trust. And that doesn't sound too attractive to have as a vehicle, so hence the questions. But I think one of the key things that people tend to overlook is that if you set up a discretionary trust, you may have this entry charge and you may have this annual, so not annual, this 10-yearly anniversary charge. But if you settle into trust, those assets disappear from your estate immediately, the day that you set it up. So you haven't got a pet, you haven't got to survive 7 years, so you've got that certainty that those assets have gone. And I think that is really, really valuable, and it still remains a very, very valuable part of inheritance tax planning.
What are they defining as disabled persons?
There is a whole list in the legislation. It talks about people that get certain, you have to have, obviously, pass certain medical conditions, and be in receipt of certain benefits as well.
So
and
if you've called current receipt of disability,
yes,
not allowing for the fact they might change the rules.
Absolutely. So they set out what the criteria are, and I haven't listed them there because it's quite voluminous. But it is set out in statute what a disabled trust would comprise, or how the person would qualify. And if they change the rules, then hopefully they'll update the legislation as well.
I think there's still a it is a bit of a conundrum, because the tax benefits of trusts have arguably fallen away largely, but asset protection is still necessary. There's still that, we talked about that slight aversion to the ongoing management, but always fact and circumstance dependent. We were talking with a client last year where she was in a fortunate position, single woman. She'd got a young son, and she was looking to gift her son, who's a minor, who's 3 years of age, a £2.5 million property with a rental income to pay school fees and that kind of thing. And I was going blue in the face telling her, you know, put it into a trust. How do you know when he's 18? You might go and blow the lot on cannabis one night, who knows what he'll do? How do you know how he's... And she was just totally close to the idea of a trust for asset protection, just in case he ran amok with it when he was 18, and she just went off and did it. So, well, ultimately, that's your decision kind of thing. But oddly enough, it came, because he was a minor, it came back to her as guardian anyway, and it was really quite messy. So they're quite unusual circumstances, but there are good reasons in those circumstances for wanting to keep a trust.
So I mentioned that very valuable, comes out of your estate immediately. Compare that to the previous regime where, yes, you could have discretionary trusts, and you used to have also what you probably know as interest in possession trusts, where somebody may, for example, have a right to the income for life, but what happened was the value of that trust fell into their estate on death. So you can see that it was nice when you had the choice. Do you want to use the what they call the IIPs, or do you want to use these discretionary trusts? Now you've got the discretionary trust regime in, and you can still have those rules for disabled and certain other charitable trusts, and certain trusts set up on death. But in the main, we're talking about the discretionary trust regime now. So we have indeed. We've done most of this anyway. Let's just move forward. I think just
a point there really that we've not covered probably is the yes, there's an immediate IHT charge, but any capital gains can be held over. So we're not facing capital gains and inheritance tax on entry into a trust.
We're not, and the reason that works is that you have to have a potential charge to inheritance tax, but it could be at 0%, and then you could still get your holdover. So, for example, if it's within the nil rate band, it would be charged at 0%. But because you've got that charge, even at 0%, you can hold over. So it's a bit quirky, but it works very favourably.
Yeah.
So let's just talk about some reliefs. So we talked about exemptions. Let's talk about reliefs. And we touched on it there. One of the key things that you as accountants will come across is relevant business property. And a lot of people think, okay, I've got a genuine trading business here. I don't need to worry about inheritance tax because I'm going to get 100% exemption from inheritance tax on the value of that business. And generally, that's right. Needless to say, there are lots of cases where perhaps they haven't done things actually right. They might be sitting on a whole wadge of cash, for example, because they're looking to retire. And that could actually exempt them from qualifying for business property relief.
We had a client only last year again. He, very good insurance business, various subsidiaries, cracking business. He was adamant he was going to get business property relief on transfer on his on death, transfer the shares to his son. But within his business, he had a number of investment properties that his business was occupying, so and a significant quantity of cash. And we were of the view that in excess of 20% of the balance sheet assets were non-core business, and therefore business property relief was not by any means guaranteed. As with this particular, he was hard-nosed Yorkshireman, which no disrespect to any Yorkshireman, but he was determined that his view was right and just kind of left things as they were. But just be mindful of things like balance sheet assets.
The other key point is even if your business, on the face of it, qualifies and you don't sit on large hoards of cash, you've got to have held those assets for 2 years at the date of any transfer or death for business property relief to apply. So again, that 2 years is quite crucial, and it requires some advanced planning if you're going to sell a business, for example. So you may have a client that's worked all his life, trading business, no question, business property relief should be applicable if anything happened or if he transferred any shares. The minute he sells that business and is sitting on cash, he's lost that exemption. And a lot of people forget that. You've got to plan in advance. So let's move on. And this just sets it out a bit more clearly. We talked about the 100%. There are some assets listed there that would only qualify for 50%. So, for example, if you were a partner in a partnership and you owned the premises that partnership operated from, but you owned it personally, then you probably only get 50% business property relief on the sale of that property. I don't know too many people that would hold a controlling interest of quoted shares, but if you did ever come across that circumstance,
I'd like to meet them.
they'd only get 50% relief on that.
Yes, sir.
If you did hold cash, what would you advise them to do?
Spend it. No, I was joking.
Invest it in other assets that qualified. So, for example, if they invested that cash in other qualifying businesses, maybe core to what they were doing, then that would qualify, for example. Mm. It's no easy answer, but they need to get it out of that balance sheet.
Yeah, it's interesting, facts and circumstances always, but the 80-year-old couple we talked about, they're so matter-of-fact about it, they asked us to check their actuarial life expectancy, and the husband was 89 and the wife was 91, apparently. That was when they were... So, that's how long we've got. And it was literally this mechanical, the discussion. Lovely couple. But we, you know, clearly 7 years to fully remove wealth out of their estate was potentially a bit marginal. So we were kind of said, well, counselling them around, okay, we need to do a mixed bag here of things. And talk about quoted shares. Yeah, investments in unquoted shares, such as AIM, for example, 2 years for inheritance tax purposes comes out of your estate. So we were encouraging them to invest in AIM stocks, and actually there's a natural nervousness around that. And actually, but our financial planning guys advocate this, and they think they've got a good portfolio of AIM stocks that actually minimise risk. But when you actually looked at it, and when we balanced it off and said, well, okay, you're looking at 40%, just say it's a million, you're looking at 40%. So if you can get that out of your estate, even if within 2 years, great. But the value of that investment's got a nosedive quite considerably to make you worse off compared to 40% tax. They go, yeah, that's true. So they ploughed a bit into that. So yeah, spend it, alternative investments. But it's great discussion points. And great.
Is it 2 year rule applied to that cash?
Yes.
It's that investment.
Yeah. You'd have to own the AIM stocks for 2 years as well.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Business property relief. I've got a client that owns a shop outside the company, which is used by the shop, by the limited company. Owned by there's a lease between the individual and the limited company.
Okay.
The market value as a shop is probably 250,000, but for redevelopment purposes, it's probably worth more than a million. Would you get business property relief on the million or the 250,000?
Yeah. That's an interesting one, isn't it? I would say for that, he probably needs to get that in a trust, doesn't he, for his children?
Yeah, probably does, actually.
Well, he's actually got it on a 25-year lease, so they can't do anything without the company's agreement within 25 years, and the owner is 79.
Yeah. But to be honest, standing here right now, I'd have to, not thinking on my feet sharp enough to answer the question. I'd love to take it offline and talk about it, if you'd like to do that.
Sure.
Very happy to do that. I'm conscious of time as well, and we're keen to kind of get through, but really interesting point.
Yeah.
And we've only got 15 minutes, apparently.
So similar relief to business property relief is agricultural property relief, which you may or may not have clients that are farming. I think the key there is, again, you've got this 2 year period and you've got some special rules that come in there for tenanted properties. But what you have to watch out for here are the lifestyle or hobby farmers that have this magnificent farmhouse, don't actually do much farming. I think there's a bit of a question mark as to whether they get inheritance tax relief on the value of that that small estate, shall we say.
It's certainly the kind of thing that's regularly challenged. So it's just to get, if we, that's what we're planning to do, let's just get our ducks in a row and prepare for the challenge.
So we're just coming on interaction with other taxes, which we touched on very, very briefly earlier on. So if you give cash, no consequences for CGT purposes. If you gift assets, there is a possibility to hold over capital gains tax, as we mentioned earlier. If you transfer between spouses and civil partners, then you should take on the other spouse or civil partner's base cost. So those are the key ones, but the holdover is the most useful thing. For example, if you were planning to set up a trust to put some assets into that trust that currently qualified for, say, business property relief, you could say there were shares, you could hold over the gain and say, for example, there was a plan to sell that business. That's a great way of moving assets into a trust maybe for the next generation without a tax cost. But then the trust is going to end up with its cash, which is great, because if you sold the business then decided you want to give the cash, you've got to wait 7 years. So it's really just a case of getting the timing right, and you can make some very, very simple, non-aggressive planning suggestions to your clients that really will benefit them.
I have seen the claims to holdover relief fall apart at various levels. One, because donor and recipient didn't necessarily agree. and actually, one example where the advisor got finger pointed at them because it's kind of, well, you didn't tell us that both had to agree, and so there's a bit of risk management there in terms of how we give that advice and document it. But there was nothing documented between the donor. Just keep repeating the same thing. Contemporaneous documentation that both parties agree and understand the implications that the original base cost then falls onto the recipient makes things go away a lot easier at a later date, and just risk management as advisors that the parties are aware of that.
I just mentioned the stamp duty there for completeness, but if you're making a proper gift, it shouldn't be an issue, is the point I'm trying to make. Okay, just very briefly, I just want to ask you all a question, and I want you to be honest with me here. How many of you don't have a will?
Look at that! Far more than we expected.
And if you have a will, how many of you have not renewed it or reviewed it within the last 5 years?
That's the rest of the audience.
The point I want to make here really is that it's so important that if you're talking to clients about any form of tax planning, that you also think about, are their wishes actually reflected in their wills, or do they have a will? So I thought we'd just take some time out just to understand what the consequences of not having an up-to-date will are, or not having a will at all. For a start, the bottom point there, and I know that the government is looking at this, if you don't have a will, you're intestate, cohabiting partners do not feature anywhere. They don't come anywhere in the intestacy rules, and if they had been supported by the deceased, they would have to go to court to prove that actually they were looked after by this person and they had a claim on the estate. And that is not, I suppose, what most clients would want for their family. So it's really important that they have a will in place that actually gives them the opportunity to direct what happens to their assets, and also prevents a lot of heartache and legal costs and accounting costs, you know, for their beneficiaries.
Yeah, and if you just look at the order, I'm damn certain I don't want my brother's children getting any of my assets, so I ought to get a will sorted out. So, you know, it's just the whole control thing, isn't it? We're not all control freaks, really, but you don't want it going in that order, do you?
It's another talking point with your clients, another reason to pick up the phone and just sort of mention this, because it's so important.
It's interesting, there's a National Will Week, isn't there, every year?
Yeah.
Is it a month, is it?
Yeah, it's a month.
It seems to be the domain of the lawyers.
Yes.
Tell me why. It doesn't need to be, does it?
You can do the planning with your client and just get somebody to actually execute the document for you. You don't just have to hand the whole thing over. So,
I'm sure they get things a bit wrong. A woman has a child and she either then isn't married to the father, or she divorces the father, or he dies or something. She then remarries. The new husband adopts the child. Now, presumably the child therefore falls out of its biological father's inheritance.
I mean,
thank you.
Because I am half adopted, and there was money on my natural father's side that I wasn't allowed to have because I'd come out of it. I can only claim for my mother's estate. So that is exactly the case.
Okay. That's why I love doing these sessions, because often the audience answers the question for us.
Thank you very much. Okay, we've only got 10 minutes left, so we've got a couple of slides here which show the situation where you have a surviving spouse or civil partner and no will, and that basically shows that actually you only get 450. If the estate's worth more than that, the rest of the estate then gets divided amongst the rest of the family. And the following slide just talks about the situation if you've got a surviving spouse, partner and children. Then you look down to the 250,000. I don't think too many people would like the idea of their children so getting half of the residue, no matter how young they are. So again, you need a will, and your clients need wills. So just quickly whiz through I think this is really important. We just wanted to touch towards the end on some planning issues. I mentioned insurance, and it may seem very obvious to everyone, but actually don't overlook the fact that you don't need to do convoluted tax planning. You just may need to get clients to have some sensible insurance in place. And as life expectancy increases, the rates are reducing. So it doesn't reduce the inheritance tax liability. It just gives the family a means to pay an inheritance tax bills. And if you've got clients that are resistant to moving assets around, or they're a bit nervous about giving things away, then the least they should be doing is making sure that they've got enough insurance in place to cover any liability. I think it's quite key as well that final point on that slide there. If you make gifts and you're a bit nervous about surviving the 7 years, or at least the 3 years, so you get some taper, again, you can take some term assurance out.
Yeah. It has an unfortunate connotation in just the fact it's insurance, but actually it's a genuinely good inheritance tax planning tool. We use it quite regularly, and it just manages risk. And most clients we present, we talk about it to, we'll enter into it. So,
yeah. And I think the final point on the next slide is really that the premiums can be paid by the donor, because they should normally be within the 3,000 annual exemption. So again, they're not making another gift. But you need to make sure that those policies are written in trust. Otherwise, the proceeds will just fall into the estate and you'll have to pay tax on it, which actually doesn't help. That's why you're doing it in the first place. So, I mean, we touched on using trusts in tax planning. Hopefully I've managed to convince you that, yes, you do need to be aware, but they still have their uses. I think we've covered all these points previously. And I think the final point is usually the one that helps to win clients over, where they can settle money into a trust. They can be a trustee without any adverse consequences for their own tax position, as long as they're not beneficiaries. So they can still direct what happens and provide guidance to the money or the assets. So they've got this ring fence, they've got this comfort blanket that they know that they've taken it out of their estate. They can still direct and guide, but the beneficiaries can't get their hands on it just yet. So that's normally quite a good position to be in. But again, it's, as John mentioned earlier, it's really asset protection that we see these used for these days. Pilot trusts. I don't know whether anybody in here has heard of pilot trusts. We could spend about 2 hours explaining the in-depth consequences of these, but I think you probably understand enough of what I've talked about already. If I just explain very briefly that what these do is enables you to set up trusts during your lifetime, say £10 per trust, and the idea is that you set them up, if you want more than one, on subsequent days. The £10 that we mention here is a deliberately nominal sum, which should fall within somebody's annual exemption rather than the nil rate band, which means that when you set each trust up, you should still have your full nil rate band available. Now, clearly, if somebody's done other tax planning, they may not be the case, but for most people, it will be. So if you set these trusts up, you haven't used a nil rate band, you can add further assets in a couple of years' time or a month's time. And if you add the further assets all on the same date, they won't be regarded as related settlements. So each of these trusts will still have their full nil rate band available. So when you gift out or you distribute assets out from the trust or you come to your 10 yearly charge, you've got £325,000 within each trust to take off before any tax comes into play. So it's quite a neat idea and we're seeing it being used more, but this is one of those cases where you've actually got to be so methodical in the way that you do it or you won't end up with several 325,000 nil rate bands. You can also set them up in your lifetime and add the assets to the trusts on death. And if it comes via a will, it's all deemed to be gifted into that trust on the same date. So again, you should have nil rate bands available for each of those trusts where the assets come in on death. So unless the donor or the deceased has done some tax planning within the 7 years up to the date of death, you should have 325,000 per pilot trust. So it's a bit more sophisticated than what we talked about to date, but I think it's quite an interesting concept. And I mentioned that don't just discount trusts. There are ways of making them use very useful, actually.
So you as obviously with the right client, wealthy enough client, doing this can save their estate significant amounts of money. So as advisors, you know, as Lynn says, timing is the essence, is key. So advisors, you quite frankly, you can earn good fees out of the management of the implementation. Should be able to earn good fees on the idea in itself because of the tax saving. What we're talking about is very high level, and it needs to be well managed, but it is a fantastic opportunity with the right client who's got the right wealth.
So we just talk there.
Yeah.
This phrase, immediate post-death interest trust, that's a bit of a mouthful, but that's like the old interest in possession trust that we used to have. So somebody, for example, could have what they call an IPDI coming out of a will where they have the assets for life and then the capital's passed on. So if you don't want that and you want something that's going to fall into what we call the relevant property regime, i.e. into one of these pilot trusts, and so it's immediate outside that person's estate, then you can bypass that regime by using a pilot trust. So lots of ways you can use them, and unfortunately we don't have time to go into the detail, but hopefully that will give you some food for thought. So finally, we wanted to talk about excluded property trusts. These are suitable for non-UK domiciled clients that are not yet deemed domiciled. And I mentioned the 17 out of 20 years earlier. So you can do some planning with offshore assets before clients become deemed domicile and put them in a trust, and that keeps them outside of the UK tax net once they become deemed domicile. But of course, if you haven't spoken to your clients before that 17 out of 20 years comes to pass, it's too late. But it's quite simple. It's not really that sophisticated, and you know, it's not controversial. It's just ring fencing those assets.
But it's the kind of thing that wealthy people do, but more often, people can fall through the net as well. So.
Okay, I think we've unfortunately run out of time. I think you've got slides with all the other sort of pages on there. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your interaction. If anybody's got any other questions, please grab us afterwards.
Yeah, I was going to say thank you very much to Lynn, John, for that informative session. You can grab any of the Mazzos team are going to be here over the next couple of days. They'll be joining us for dinner tonight as well, so there'll be an opportunity for you to ask questions about any specific issues you've got with any of your own clients. One other thing to mention is that there is a free prize draw for a bottle of champagne, I believe.
There is indeed.
And if you'd like to drop your business card in to the bucket that Mia's, my beautiful assistant, about to hold up, there we are. Excellent. On your way out. The final thing to mention is coffee. Is going to be available in your next session, which starts at 20 past. So you've got a couple of minutes to get yourselves to your one of the next three streams. So thank you very much. If we could just show our appreciation in the usual way, please. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay.
Thank you.
Scoot. Thank you, everybody.
Sorry? Yeah, it's a shame you're going to stop.